Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.
Telling you, bro. What's been happening, bro?
Not too much.
Still hitting more Peggy-O's.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Riff Raff, coronavirus edition number 2. Seriously, I hope everybody is staying healthy, has stayed healthy. It's been interesting to see how this has all played out since the last episode of Riff Raff with Greg V. The whole thing had just started happening, but wow, I hope everybody is okay. My guest today, Mr. Alan Hines. Alan is a fantastic guitar player, teacher, performer, sideman. Met him years and years ago when I was a student at MI in Hollywood, California. Now, Alan's still there teaching to this day, but he's branched out, had a successful career as a sideman, and as of late, maybe 10 years or so, a solo artist. So we're listening to one of his songs now called Falling Up. If I may deviate for a second with a crazy analogy that, trust me, goes somewhere, you know, those of you that know anything about cooking, South Louisiana, New Orleans cuisine, there's the base of a lot of dishes. It's known as the Holy Trinity. It's like a Catholic reference, but Holy Trinity is bell pepper, celery, onion. You have those three things, you're in good shape. You can make a lot of great classic dishes. And in a weird way, I always make food analogies to music, but Alan's playing exemplifies. It reminds me of that in a certain way. But his are the three T's of guitar playing: tone, taste, and touch. And he has all of these in spades, as you hear. Got a beautiful touch, legato sound. So, in this interview, we talk about a lot of things. Alan's played with Gino Vannelli, B.B., C.C. Wyans, Randy Crawford, lots of other people, but I think he will agree that the most rewarding thing for him has been his own solo career, which we'll talk about. He's got a new record called The Good Fight. By the time this episode is out, I don't think the record will be out, but the mixes should be done because he was mixing, so look out for it, The Good Fight. I know he's on Facebook a lot right now on doing Skype lessons. Hit him up for a Skype lesson, Alan Hines. Great teacher. I think you get a lot from a lesson with Alan right now. And what do we have but free time right now anyway? Look me up on Instagram and Shane Terrio Guitar on Facebook. On an unusually rainy day, I went over to Alan's house in beautiful Laurel Canyon, Los Angeles, and we just sat and filled with guitars and amplifiers and cats. And so we sit down and play a little bit as we usually do and talk shop. I hope you'll enjoy this. Check out Alan's new record. It should be out fairly soon. It's called The Good Fight. The Good Fight. Thanks for listening.
Thank you. I'm trying to play all my fancy licks because we're doing a podcast, so I'm trying to throw in all my altered licks that I could possibly get.
Some coronavirus licks.
Cool, man.
Yeah.
I'd make a good supporting act for you, man. You sound great.
Man. I'm sitting here in beautiful Laurel Canyon.
It is a nice day.
This is like surreal here, Alan, with my buddy Alan Hines and his... Wow, this is... I mean, if
it's
the listeners
place,
could see
it?
This, it's really special.
I lucked up a long time ago.
Why do I have headphones on? I was wondering why I couldn't hear anything. I was testing the...
Alan, can you speak closer to the mic?
Anyway, beautiful spot, man.
I lucked up here, you know, it was years ago after the earthquake in 94, and I was going to move to Atlanta, actually. I was going to get a job working at AIM.
Oh, yeah.
That was the idea, anyway, because I was kind of freaked out because I was living near the epicenter in the valley. And then somebody said, well, you know, the hills don't move as much up in the hills. So I went looking for just a little place, and I found this. My landlady was, she had this little, at the time it was just a studio apartment, so it was really small. And she did a real thorough screening because she owns a lot of properties in Hollywood, and she was... Boy, talk about riffraff. She had some like strange, you know, crazy people move in and, you know, board up all the windows and shit. So she did a big check on me, and she liked me. And I moved in, and it's been the same rent since 1994. She likes me because I pay my rent on time. Well, I can't because it's so low.
This neighborhood, for those listening, I mean, I know a little bit about it. I mean, this is like history, man. Frank Zappa lived around the corner.
the Wonderland Murders.
Wonderland Murders down the
street. No, but everybody, a lot of people live up here still. Yeah. I see celebrities all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Bonamassa has a house up here someplace.
Mm-hmm.
If you've ever heard of him.
Yeah. Killer.
Joni Mitchell lived pretty close to the house, I guess our house was written for. She and Graham Nash were living together. Like right when you come here on the Hollywood side or the Valley side? If you came up to the Hollywood
side,
you live right past their house.
And
it's
LA
a beautiful,
shops. Yeah.
Nice green house set up and back up on the hills.
I mean, you probably find a good deal on a place up here, man. I imagine it's not too expensive.
You still can, actually. I mean, you can still. Because there are a lot of the houses up here. It's the land that's so good. There's a lot of houses that were built really kind of cheaply back then. I have a girlfriend who's looking for a house up here, and she actually... found one for like really cheap.
Wow.
But the house itself is crap.
Yeah, you need to rebuild the whole thing. Yeah.
Like a geodesic dome back in the 70s, you know, but the land is like awesome. Yeah, it's beautiful up here. And it's always about 10 degrees cooler than the rest of Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. And I have a little creek outside that's always running year round. There are natural springs up here in the hills, which I didn't know about until I moved up here.
Great place to create, man. Looks like it works for you. You know, I just want to tell the listeners, I usually do a little context backstory. Alan, I went to MI back, you know, years and years ago, and you're still teaching there. I took a couple of open counselors with you, man. You must have been really, really young at the time. I never had a class.
No, I'm just really old now.
No,
what happened was I was like that. I went in 85 and 86. And you know, the school's full of great players, and Jeff Buckley was there, and Jimmy Herring, and you know. We were all trying to be, at the time, everybody was trying to be Larry Carlton or Joe Pass, you know, those, or Robin Ford. That was, shredding wasn't really in yet. It wasn't really that scene yet. It was mostly like the early Robin Ford. And it was a great environment, Mac. The school was only a year long. Was it a year long when you were there? Was that your program?
And but it was intense.
The best thing about that was being able to go sit with somebody you liked
Absolutely.
And play with them. That was the coolest
you
thing.
You and Scott and, you know, Dan Gilbert was my private teacher.
When I was there before, I'd walk down the hallway and be like Joe Pass and Jeff Berlin and Scott Henderson and Frank Gambale and Jennifer Batten was always there. Joe DiOrio was awesome. And Robin was there. When I was there, Robin Ford was there 1 week out of every month.
Wow.
The whole year I was there. So that whole... I would just take off from all my other classes and sit with him. Because I knew all his solos. I transcribed all his stuff from Joni Mitchell to Little Feet when he played on one Little Feet record. And I mean, I knew all his licks. And so I used to sit there with him and just play. And he would surprise me. He plays really great over chord changes. I wish he did that more. That was my favorite thing he did. You know, the early Yellow Jacket stuff was pretty heady stuff.
Yeah.
For a predominantly what we all thought was a blues guitar player. But he was awesome. And he was interesting because when Robin would play, he would look at a song like, you know, Anna Maria, or a song that has like tons of really hard changes in it, which is a Wayne Shorter song.
Wayne Shorter, Anna Maria.
And he'd look at it, and I think he was just kind of looking for those pivot chords where the tonality would shift or where the five chord would go into a new key. And then he'd take his eyes completely off the chart. And then he'd just start playing. So it freed him up to where, and I think that's why he should always connect with everybody so well, because he's really coming from the heart and not from the head when he plays, you know. And I just noticed that about him when he played over chord changes, because he always has a real fluid approach over him. You know, it doesn't sound like he's going into melodic minor mm-hmm. scale when it hits. It sounds like he's just flowing from his blues ideas over the tops of the changes. And that's what I really miss about his playing. I wish he did more of that, because that was really special. Mm-hmm. You know, the Yellow Jacket stuff. There's a Klaus Ogerman record where he plays really mm-hmm. great on an old
record. Oh, I know those records. Yeah, he did a couple with Michael Brecker and Klaus Ogerman. So Robin was there. I mean, that was like the heyday, Howard Roberts.
That was like the heyday. And I got hired. Actually, Tommy Tedesco hired me to teach at MI afterwards.
Oh, wow. I was going to ask you how you got the gig.
Yeah, they used to have these suggestion meetings or grievance meetings, whatever. At the end of every quarter, they have all the students sit together and voice their, you know, concerns and how they could improve the school or whatever. That's my cat, Boo.
Boo.
And so somebody raised their hand and said, Alan Hines should be teaching here. And so Tommy Tedesco said, who's this Alan Hines? So I stood up and he gave me a job the next day.
Wow.
Yeah, it was pretty cool. I mean, you start off doing the grunt work, you know, doing like private lessons all day long. When I started working outside of school, then I became kind of like a visiting faculty, and they couldn't give me study hours. So I'd just go in there and like sit in a big room and show off like I do now at the school. Well,
I still have, I showed you what you were in. Alan's sister lives in New Orleans. So I have a house in New Orleans, and Alan came over a month or so ago.
Yeah, what a beautiful house that is.
And thank you, man.
Houses,
and
you just need to move it up here.
I wish I could. Yeah, and anyway, you came into my studio and I showed you a handout from your open counseling workshop from God knows when that was.
Yeah.
And it had some great stuff on it.
Yeah.
Chromaticism and all that. I still work on some of that stuff.
You know,
sometimes.
It's weird because everybody else asked me about my legato technique, and that was kind of the beginning of that. And really, I was trying to emulate Holdsworth the best I could. You know, and nobody really could. I mean, he was just so harmonically deep, and I could never understand the harmonic part of it. But there's just so much beauty in his fast flurries of notes that became like big walls of sound. You know, that I thought that was always the most attractive thing.
Sound,
and he was really. He never got enough credit for being as melodic. I don't think, because the early Tony Williams stuff and some of his early records, I mean, he just played Jean-Luc Ponty stuff.
Yeah.
He played some beautiful melodies, just the slow stuff, you know. You hear everybody else frantically trying to play over the changes, and it comes time for his solo, and there's one song in the Jean-Luc Ponty album where they're trading fours.
I know what you're talking about.
There's like four or five. There's a keyboard. There's another guitar player. I think it's Daryl Sturmer,
yeah. Yeah. Steve Smith and Jean-Luc Ponty.
And they're all great, but, you know, when Holdsworth gets there, it's just like, whoa.
Oh, it's another world,
it's
man.
Another level, yeah. He was.
Even when you look at the old clips of Holdsworth, like with, what was that band he was in?
Soft Machine or UK? Or
Soft Machine. Mm. Or was it Gong? There's some stuff on YouTube where he's playing like an SG
Marshall SG?
With not a drip of reverb, like completely unforgiving sound, and killing it, man. Like no two delays going on.
He's really special. I've had so many students come to me and say, you know, because I can kind of do a legato thing, and I, you know, I might luck up and whatever. They always go there with me. Maybe because my name is Alan. That happened in the store a few times. Somebody who was visiting the store heard somebody else in the store call me, "Hey, Alan." And they said, "Oh man, I love all your stuff." Then I realized they were talking about Alan Holdsworth.
Well, yours is Alan Holdsworth was what, Allan, and yours
That's
is
right.
Ian, right?
Ian, yeah. But still, maybe it's but anyway, so the students always like ask me about this stuff, or when they ask me, or when we bring up Holdsworth, they all say, "Yeah, but his stuff was way so outside," and so I couldn't really get any of it. And then I put on one of their old recordings, like the stuff from Heavy Metal Fatigue.
Yeah,
some of that shit is like. It's just beautiful. It's just.
Well, when you listen to like, because I was a big Van Halen fan, and you know Eddie was a big fan
sure.
of Alan, and actually he got him his record deal, Warner Brothers, and was supposed to produce that record.
Oh, I didn't know. I knew that there was a connection there with Warner.
He was supposed to produce it. That was the deal. But Van Halen was so busy at the time that he couldn't commit to a certain date, and Alan supposedly got frustrated, so he just did the record himself. But if you listen to like. There's a Van Halen tune called Top Jimmy and Drop Dead Legs. The ending solo is total Holdsworth. The whammy,
sure.
that like the whole...
The real
totally
widespread intervals on single string
all
stuff.
All this kind of like...
Sure.
You
have like
that,
repeating notes and notes that go down in sequence
patterns,
instead of up.
Diminished thing, but
yeah.
He was a big influence.
Yeah, and you know, and back when we were trying to figure stuff out, we didn't have the amazing slower down or any kind of software to help. So half of the fun was just a journey, you know, trying to figure out, you know, slowing down a record to like 16 and a half or whatever a record turntable would turn down to, and trying to figure out the notes. So half the notes were wrong, and probably played in a different place. But that you kind of got your own thing. You know, you'd come as close as you could, but you could never get it exactly right. And I think it's one I still tell my students now when they're transcribing anything. You know, don't go to YouTube and get somebody to show you how to do it. Use your ear, because that's where you kind of learn. Mm-hmm. That's where you really learn. You know, it's like, I think the difference between watching a movie and reading a book. You know, you have to use your imagination so much more if you're having to really figure out where on the fretboard you can even finger the damn thing.
Well, so I remember on your handout, I was talking about the worksheet. You talked about transcribing. And did you spend a lot of time transcribing?
Yeah, I think we all did. You know, I mean, I was first, you know, Scott Henderson got me into that. Like, he had, so that, we just assumed that was the thing to do. So, yeah, and I still have like a lot of notebooks here full of like Scofield and Michael Brecker. Mm-hmm. I found learning, you know, saxophone licks was really fun for guitar.
What was the? Do you remember the Dave Sanborn lick that you had on that handout?
Probably so, because I only have about four or five licks. but no, there's one. Was it like this is a blues lick, right?
I don't know. I thought it was. That's cool too. Oh, that's cool. I don't think that was it.
There's an alter lick that I used to play, a diminished lick I still use all the time because it flows really nice on the guitar. And that's a.
Oh, nice.
Like over.
Is that Michael Brecker?
Brecker.
Yeah.
Which is really nice. But yeah, on guitar, you can get this going on. If I can. I'm not really quite warmed up. You can just kind of hammer on stuff and make it work. We were all stealing stuff, and I was, you know, taking the road of least resistance. I kind of figured out that if I was hammering on when ascending and pulling off when descending, it kind of sounded like Holdsworth. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of my approach. Right, and plus I could never, I held my pick really like that with three fingers and hold it sideways, so I can't do a hybrid thing at all. And my single string picking has always sucked. Has always, you know, whenever I try to go, it's like really hard for me to do. Or, I could do it. I could go.
Yeah.
You know, by hammering on.
It's a real fluid sound. I remember even back in the day at MI, I remember you had that Strat with the Floyd Rose on it, the old Strat. And
I was in a Floyd Rose. That was the first, that was even before Floyd Rose, I think. It was called the Rockinger.
Oh, wow.
And I ordered it from Guitar Player Magazine, and I had two big screws that went right through the headstock.
Oh. Devaluation. It was a 65 Strat. There.
No rally. They had just sitting there cranking it on there. Didn't realize that, you know, if you force, I've learned since then, you know, forcing the screw without drilling the hole first, you can crack the whole headstock apart. The maple's so hard, you know.
You don't want to practice that shit on a 65 Strat.
Yeah, but who knew at the time?
But I remember I remember watching your right hand, how it was just so fluid, you know.
Yeah.
And even now, I'm watching you. So.
Well, I wasn't quite warmed up in our first little jam there, so I played some goofy stuff.
Come on, man. It's not goofy. The goofier, the better, obviously.
I have a really light. I mean, I haven't broken a string like in 40 years. Or,
wow.
You know, my right hand is really super light, and I actually don't pick a lot of times. I do that a lot. Where I'm just kind of. And I kind of rely on the amp for the volume. But the dynamically, it seems like there's more of a open window there for dynamics when you do the legato thing.
We'll be right back. your volume knob turned down, and then
it's pretty much all the way up all the time.
All the way up.
I can actually.
So your hands are controlling the.
On my, I play my Esquire a lot. My 52 Esquire, and it has a bypass position on it. You know, it bypasses all the tone, and it's just like wide open. And I use that all the time. It's control everything. I became a volume pedal slave. You know, back in the Larry Carlton, Robin Ford days, because everybody was using that.
Yeah.
That kind of stuff.
Drives soundmen crazy, by the way.
Say again?
It drives soundmen crazy.
And studio stuff.
I know.
I've done those sessions before where it's like halfway on. They go, Alan, your volume is changing.
What happened to the level? It just jumped.
I know, believe me, I know.
Yeah. It's a cool sound, though. Yeah. It's... So how did you get from... So you were at the school, and then you're still at the school, but you've been able to dip one toe into real world guitar playing. I mean, working cat, like, you know, some of the gigs you've had, like Gino Vannelli comes to mind. And
I used to never really want to be. I got the gig just because I needed the money. We were all like, you know, just kind of starving in Hollywood and looking for anything. And teaching at MI was a great way to make extra money. Are you kidding me? It was a prestigious school, and it was. I wasn't really into. I wasn't even trying to. Analyze what I was doing. I mean, I really don't know if I had that much to really show anybody. I was just kind of showing off, and I guess I played for 10 years with commercial bands in Alabama, so I kind of had a idea of how to play a lot of different styles. And I played in bands while my rhythm playing was pretty good. So, and that got better, of course, playing with a lot of R&B artists after school. But as time went on, I mean, I realized how much fun it is to teach when you get the right student, when you get somebody who's really growing and listening and getting and knowing that what you offer them has made a big change in their life, made them a better player. That's really a great feeling. I mean, it goes really unrewarded a lot of times, but it really feels as it reflects in my pay at the school. Different story. But no, I mean, I've had so many students, you know, I had a lot of great students. You were there, and you were like Toshi Yanagi or Justin Derek and those guys. I mean, they were already good when they got there. I mean, you would have been a good player whether you had gone to MI or not. I think it was just you kind of went there and got what you wanted out of it. So I didn't.
I mean, I was 19 when I was there. It was so, you know, it was.
It was kind of a magical place back then, wasn't it?
It really was.
We had kind of all read about it. It was like this mecca out in California of all the best guitar players. There wasn't anything like it around.
It really was a great, man. It was one of the best years of my life, honestly. It was such a great time.
Me too.
I just went through a lot of shit there. And like, I kind of grew up in that couple of years I spent in Hollywood. I mean, it was like,
I think we all do, you know, like everything. When you actually end up sitting next to the people, you know, sitting next to somebody like Robin Ford, who you had just idolized and who's done so much in the world of guitar. I mean, you soak it up, you know, enough talent where you took that stuff and ran with it and made it your own. I mean, a lot of guys just kind of go there and don't, you know, they weren't really meant to be, or they never really took it that seriously. You know, they kind of a hobby and they kind of learned a few things, went back home and got a job at their, wherever they were supposed to
get. Well, my roommate at the time, man,
who's that?
I hope he ever listens to this.
Who?
I'd rather not say his name. Oh. I don't think he ever even showed up for any of your classes, but he would basically, the first week we all moved in together, we're all hanging and I made friends and these French guys, we were playing standard and stuff. And he had these covers of Rush tunes and Boston tunes that he had, nothing wrong with any of that, but he basically did it on his four track note for note, copped all the solos and he played it for me. I go, wow, that's great. And he was still working on the same sheet a year later, and he just missed all his classes. He like barely made it through.
Yeah,
and
I've seen all kinds. There's a lot of people who do that. There's a lot of guys who are really so insecure to the point that they make up excuses for everything, for not learning stuff. I mean, there's all sorts. It's like it's like being a psychologist there at school, you know, trying to. But that's kind of the magic of it, is trying to bring that part out of a kid's personality. I've seen this one Japanese guy named Joichiro Natori, and he works for Yamaha now in Tokyo. Mm-hmm. But he was the shyest, this little effeminate guy who sit in the corner of my room and just like sit there, and he's really super nice, real quiet, really shy, and he just blossomed into such a great. And then towards the end of the second year, he started playing some shows. I was going, Joey, that's awesome. His time was great, his touch was great, and now he's like he transcribes for Yamaha. He has his perfect pitch. We stay in touch, but that was really one of my highlights of teaching, is like seeing somebody like him kind of grab it and run with it, you know, and that's really, that's super rewarding when you can make a difference in somebody's life and think that you might have had something to do with that, you know, that you might
absolutely
have given them something.
It's a good, very powerful thing, man.
Yeah, even though, I mean, it's like, but I needed more. I mean, I have too much of an ego. I was like performing stuff live, and I waited way too late in my life and started writing my stuff, not until like 2005 when I did my first record. You know, I should have been writing when I was, you know, 20 years before that, because that's really the most rewarding feeling ever. As you probably know, having your own CDs out and getting them finished and knowing that they get kind of accepted out there.
Do you feel that being at the school or any school, not just MI, or being a teacher, sometimes it's a comfortable, it's something to fall on to where you don't really want.
Well, you get comfortable
this
in doing that and don't pursue the stuff that you really.
Anything,
I've seen that happen. I can name some names that you know too that I won't. But I've seen it happen. There's a lot of teachers like that. Sure, you get comfortable paying the rent, you know, and with the certain amount of hours you have kind of locked down at the school, and you're kind of a fixed income there, and you're teaching, you become the guy, the teacher at school, and it takes up a lot of your time. You know, the thing I didn't like about teaching at school is if I would teach private lessons like 8 hours a day, I mean, the last thing I wanted to do when I got out of school was play more guitar. Mm-hmm. And I found out it took away from me doing my own thing and really playing what I wanted to play, you know, because I would. At the time, now I do open counseling, but I sit in a big room now and just kind of do whatever I want to do. I can play whatever I want to play. But back then, I really had to stick to the curriculum and teach them the cage positions and all the arpeggios and this and that. And that was just so, I mean, I was drinking like 30 cups of coffee a day just to stay awake, and I was just kind of hating it, you know. And so when I cut my hours back on there and started doing real work outside of school, I was a much happier guy. So it all depends, I guess, on what level you're teaching at and how much you're doing. I mean, now the way I look at it, it's helped me kind of, it gives me a stronger foundation of what I know about music. The fact that I can, you know, sit in a master class in Japan and try to explain how to practice or how modes work, you know, it kind of reinforces your own fundamental understanding of guitar. Mm-hmm. And so in that way, it's kind of good therapy for yourself. It's just a good.
Yeah, you learn more by teaching. Even
you kind of go, well, what do I really know? How would I explain this? And do I really understand this? And it kind of makes you figure things out in a way. Because there's a lot of great players who can't really teach.
Mm-hmm.
I know,
sure.
Okay, boo, okay.
You want me to ask you a question, too?
Yeah, really?
The Gino Vannelli gig, how did that come out?
Jimmy Haslip was a friend of mine, bass player from the Yellow Jackets, and he had recommended me the year before, and I couldn't do it because I was playing with Bobby Caldwell, I think, at the time, or maybe I was doing a Randy Crawford gig or something. But Gino had heard of me, and then he needed a guitar player a year later. I guess he'd gone through a few people, and he called me, and I went up, he had me learn some stuff. We talked on the phone, we got along. Gino's an interesting guy. We talked on the phone, he had a good sense of humor, and we seemed to hit it off. I learned all the stuff and flew up there and had a good week of audition rehearsal type things with him. And so that's how I got that. Gino's an interesting guy. You know, he's an incredibly great musician. And I wish he was a lot more famous than he is, because he's kind of only known to my generation, or, you know, in Canada he's really famous. But he's a super talented guy. I mean, he sits down and kind of goes into this little trance and starts writing stuff on piano, and you kind of go, or on guitar. And he's, you know, comes up with, he's just great stuff. You know, he's probably, he's very particular and very picky. So that might be his, he might be his own worst enemy in that respect, and that he tries to perfect everything. And I wish he'd have like a John Leventhal or somebody produce him, or somebody mm-hmm. else take and say, no, it's great, loose
well,
like
doesn't
it is.
His brother have some sort of creative input? Or is
oh,
he just...
yeah, he had three brothers. Ross Vanelli, who worked sound for us, I guess does commercials and some TV stuff up here. And the piano player, Joe Vanelli.
That's who I'm thinking of.
But they had a falling out. Actually, I was with Gino for 3 years. I never met Joe once.
Wow.
Because I don't know what it was, if it was artistic or if it was personal. You know, families are. Families can be kind of... just because you're the same blood doesn't mean you're always a whole lot alike.
Well, like the Black Crowes or like, you know, Oasis. I mean, those are some pretty brutal brotherhood partnerships.
Yeah, we have seven kids in my family, so I just know, you know, and I'm pretty close to a few of them. You know, my sister in New Orleans, and there's some other ones I haven't talked to in years just because we're just different.
Oh, I didn't know that. Wow, I just want to say.
We have seven. I have a brother who's conducts a symphony in Alabama.
Nice.
Montgomery Symphony Orchestra. Yeah, he's a... But we had some personal things happen in the family that we just don't... but I know Joe is a great... engineer and great writer. I think he did a lot of soundtrack stuff. But Gino's an awesome talent.
I heard you guys in New Orleans. I remember you got me. We hung out, and I actually met Gino, and the band sounded killer. I remember that. Mm. When was that? That was about 10 years ago. Probably.
Yeah, that was a great band. Randy Porter on keyboards, great keyboard player, and Reinhardt Meltz. The only person left is Reinhardt. They're all Portland guys now.
Well, you were going to tell me something about a solo you did on one of the. Do you want to tell that story now? And I can.
Yeah. Well. Where did I first hit it? There's actually an old Statler Brothers record where it's a parody of like Sunday morning group in a church, and it's called Take Off Guitars. It's like, oh, baby, take off guitar. I can't remember exactly, but it's like everything's a little bit out of tune, out of time. So it's like I'm sorry, remember. Every time you slow down, you go. You slow down. So anyway, we had a guitar player named Jim Hutchinson, this one band in Montgomery, Alabama, and he used to be able to do it really well. He'd kind of go,
oh yeah,
you know, play everything just a little bit out of tune, out of time, but it was beautiful just because it was so bad. And you know,
I used to do that with you know, blues stuff, like, you know. Actually, it sounds authentic.
I used to do it with Bobby Caldwell, when the band would be cracking. I mean, not live. I would never do that shit live. But like in rehearsal or whatever, and the band would be cracking up, you know. And Bobby used to hate it. Bobby would go, God damn it, Alan, cut that out. And he'd get really, literally pissed off. And then, but Gino loved it. I'd do it. He would just start laughing like a little kid who's being tickled, you know. So when we recorded, I recorded two CDs with him. And one of them, we did a remake of a lot of his old hits, and one was the great Brother to Brother solo Carlos Rios play that we all know. So I recorded it here at my house, and I sent him the track, and the first thing I did was like a whole parody of it, where it was like, you know, all out of tune.
That's pretty ballsy.
Yeah, well, exactly. And the engineer called me about 2 hours later and said that Gino was still like lying on the floor laughing.
Oh, great.
I'll play it for you. It's pretty awesome stuff. But then I ended up doing a serious track for him. It was really fun. A lot of hardcore changes to play over, you know.
What was the? Oh, okay.
Brother to Brother.
You did
yeah.
Brother to Brother.
Yeah, and it had changes like changes like that, like the real modal and half steps and stuff. And it's like, you know, I would always hear saxophone players play so nicely of that. For guitar, it always seemed to be those are always the hard ones, you know. Two fives are what got me a lot of gigs out of MI, you know. But I could always handle those, and even like get a lot of like. Standards I can see and navigate myself around, but when some of those songs they have like the weird half step stuff, and you know, modally you hear, I've analyzed like Michael Brecker was one of my favorite guys to transcribe, and as he should be, everybody's favorite guy to transcribe, but you know, and I bottom line is I'd end up just like singing a melody. If I couldn't figure out what scale it was, yeah. I'm just going to sing a melody. But Gino's music had posed a lot of challenges that way for guitar. So I had like, you know, three or four good solos worked out for, because I didn't want to be in front of 10,000 people and improvise and, you know, stand there.
Yeah, you got to have everybody. A few things to lay on. Of course, there's nothing wrong with that.
Gino's awesome, you know. The whole story. He told me the whole story about him kind of falling out of favor with Clive Davis back in the day, and he couldn't get out of his contract with him. So that's why, he kind of dropped off the edge of the world there for a minute, and nobody heard from Gino until years later. And yeah, it was a big mess, and he had to buy himself out of the contract. And he's an incredible singer still. He's got to be in his late 60s, and he's. All the songs are in the same original keys, and he sings all the high notes. And you know, he takes care of himself. He doesn't drink or smoke, and he does yoga, and he drinks tea, and won't talk to anybody loud for the couple of days before the shows. You know, that kind of stuff. He's real disciplined. Great writer, and amazingly good drummer and guitar player too.
Wow,
you know, he's just one of those guys. God dang it.
Oh, that's cool.
That was an exercise. Here, play this. This is cool. Now, move it up a minor third. Another minor third.
Let's see.
Yeah, it sounds really nice if it's harmony like this.
And I was just, how are you fingering that?
Well, but I do like this.
Yeah, that makes more sense. I see.
I had one song on one of my records years ago that I did that. But it was an exercise at first, and I would do it in harmony. So if you play...
It took me a second to get that.
Yeah, of course, yeah, they're all minor thirds. So it's like add nine's going... And I remember I'd written this song that goes... It's really fast. It goes like a... Something like that, and Bill's in harmony, so the other part is going like all monkeys and slides is off that record. And so I went to Japan. This guy was going to play with me, and he had been trying to learn it, like trying to play laterally up the fretboard, and I felt so sorry for him. I said, oh dude, I should have told you, I should have written you or something, you know, because he probably spent like 2 months working on trying to do it. You try to just jump up a minor third on one string, it's really freaking hard.
That's hard.
And I was just like, just
well, the other way is sort of hard too, when you don't,
well, it's easier
if I had a few minutes to put it together, but... yeah, that's really great.
But here, play it together. Here's where it's pretty, when it gets...
Yeah.
So that was the idea that I was going for, and it was just, who knows, probably drug induced at some point. But once again, that's a I pick a lot with my fingers, you know, like that. And you know, even like getting people ask me what my chord voicings are, and they really, I don't have any fancy chord voicings. I just pick the right notes out of them, you know, like the. by doing that makes one simple minor chord sound so much more.
Yeah.
It's almost like what you leave out is why it sounds
more space.
Yeah, that stuff's fun. Double track that one with a lot of like slide and ambient stuff with using that strange the palm pedal guitar all the slidey stuff. That's a real fun guitar. Have you ever seen one of those?
Nope.
A palm pedal? Actually, that's we're gonna put it. Let me show you what it does.
Sure.
Let me check. It's kind of cool. I think Dusendorf, is that the name of the company?
Duesenberg.
Duesendorf. Isn't that that's from Harry Potter? Duesenberg makes one. But this one feels better. This one feels like a Harley Davidson to me. You know, I mean, it's like it's
LSL. So sturdy.
LSL, yeah. This is one of Lance's guitars. LSL does mostly relic copies of like Strats and Telecasters, but this one he made for me. Actually, it has my daughter's name in it.
Oh yeah.
In the headstock, he did it really lightly, so it only kind of comes out in certain light.
Wow, man, I would have never known. That thing looks like it's from the late '60s or '70s.
Yeah, I had him copy my. I had a 1960 Les Paul Special.
Yeah.
And I had him copy it exactly, and then we put this one pickup in, and I put this palm pedal on it. So I'm tuned in standard, but you could always play around tunings to make it interesting. But because I'm kind of a Homer Simpson, whenever I tune a guitar to open tune, I'll kind of get it for a second, and then I'll just go back to a standard tuning lick and blow it. I can never seem to wrap my head around it too long. So I keep it in standard, but you can get stuff like. You can get those.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Those kind of nice pedals too. So, because I can't play keyboards, I end up layering a lot of guitars on my tracks. I mean, if you ever heard any of my records, they have like five guitar parts. And it all sounded fine to me because I grew up listening to Led Zeppelin, you know. So mm-hmm. There's always like layered. I slide like, you know, just doing like lower ambient. Even if it's way in the background with some reverb, was
mm-hmm. textures. And
I got that from probably Little Feet and Chris Whitley and stuff.
So the B string is going up above a second. Is that
you can adjust it to wherever you want to do a half step. This one goes up a whole step.
Yeah.
And then I have the G string also going up all steps. So I can get those. It's kind of fun, huh?
Yeah.
But you can if you know your fretboard pretty well. I mean, if somebody needs like an add nine chord or a major nine chord, you can. I know my theory well enough to know where those slash chords would be.
Yeah.
To get, like if you played A to go there, you know, to play like an E triad over the A. But that's a real great thing, and I wish they'd still made these. I mean, you can find them. I found this one off of eBay off of another guitar. I bought like a $400 Telecaster and took it off of that. Because they only made them back in the
Bigsby, huh?
60s and 70s. Every time I go to the NAMM show every year, and I say, man, please build the palm pedals again because they're cool things. I guess it's the same thing as a B bender, but it's just easier to use.
It's there, yeah.
And some of them that you can actually put six levers on it.
I think there was a Nashville guitar player named Phil Baugh. I'm pronouncing his name.
I think you're right.
70s,
and he had like a lot of them, right?
He had like he might have invented something with pedals, or I don't know, it was something. It looked like that, Yeah.
Yeah, but it's a fun, it's a great thing to do if you're a guitar player and you just want to create some pads in the back. And I've always loved, I mean, maybe it's because I grew up in Alabama, but pedal steel.
Yeah.
As always, I mean,
it's
even
a beautiful
back,
sound.
Even back to like Sneaky Pete stuff. I mean, and all the country stuff. Is the sound of steel is awesome. I've always loved you. Growing up in high school in Alabama, you have to play some slide guitar. Everyone does. I mean, I see any Bill Hines, who's a phenomenal guitar player, played with a guy named something Thorne. He used to travel around like a Littlefield, like a Roadhouse blues rock band. I'm spacing out his first name. But my friend Bill Hines is a left-handed guitar player. Everybody used to think we were brothers because spelled the same way. We both played in the best bands in Alabama at the time. Mm. He played with. He married one of the Forrester sisters, I think, from Nashville. And now he was a big Nash. He did a lot of sessions in Nashville for several years there. He's kind of retired and he's kind of gotten off the road. But he's a slide guitar player. You know, that's a guy. And there was a guy named Billy Earl McClellan. I don't know if any of you are listening, but he was a big session player in Nashville and Muscle Shoals for a while from Auburn, Alabama. Well, he's from Lynette, Georgia. But I knew him from Auburn. And when I was like 14 years old, I used to sneak into his little club in Auburn and. First time I ever heard like Allman Brothers played, you know, like a real Les Paul played through a Marshall stack, and it just blew me away. And he was awesome. He died several years ago, but he was, I think there's probably still things with him online. He was a great singer, great writer, great player, great guy. And growing up in Alabama, I saw the Allman Brothers right after Dwayne died, like months after Dwayne had died, and they still had a microphone set up for him, and Barry Oakley was still with him. And Dickie Betts was just playing great then, you know. The gold top through Marshall stack, and I actually played that guitar last year when I was in Germany at this music store. They had Dickie Betts's gold top that he'd had refinished at some point, but they were selling it over there, and I got to go upstairs and they opened the vault, played the first guitar I ever heard, first electric guitar.
Nice, man.
Yeah, that was pretty cool.
I'm thinking about those chord changes. That's the same,
Street Life, right?
Street Life. We used to do that with Boss Skaggs, and it was the same thing. And Boss had a lot of things like, you know, JoJo and all that. It had all those kind of four or four. It must have been
it's almost like you kind of give up trying to analyze what it is because it's like, I think there's exceptions to every rule I found in everything musically, whether that, you know, tritone substitution or it's this or that, and it's like there's always an exception, there's always one example you can find where that doesn't really work here,
you can play wrong or
it should be Dorian but it's
wrong.
Not
like,
you
know? Scofield would do that where he'll play pentatonic, like, you know, down like
half step away
whatever, he'll go a half step a whole step down and then go into, you know, it's like it's kind of crazy.
Yeah, and I think, you know, that's a thing when I think about people who played outside kind of stuff and it still worked, and I always wondered why. How does that possibly work? Usually it's because their time is so damn good, you know. Mm-hmm. It's like a freight train coming along that, you know, they're so committed to it. It's just like, it's going to work.
Yeah.
You know, and they just kind of do it. And there's one record a band I had called Wonderland Park, that's like a trio thing I did. Yeah. And we just kind of camped out in my friend's house and wrote a bunch of quirky stuff. And there's one solo in that one of those songs where I kind of went off. Like, I think I made a huge mistake, and I like landed on a major seven on a dominant seven chord. Something that just shouldn't be right, but I just kept repeating it in the middle of the solo, and it ended up being like the favorite part of people who listened. I said, "That's the coolest part of the song." And I remember at the time going, "I suck," you know. But you know, in the moment, you know, I learned a long time ago not to freeze up and run away, just to kind of like embrace it and kind of make it.
What's the name of that tune?
I think it's the title cut, "Just Get In."
Okay, I have that record.
It's the one. There's like a.
Tunes, but didn't he used to do like a blues with these chords? That would be the one. That kind of thing.
It sounds like something he would have done. Right? Inside story, right?
You were talking about okay. Four or five. I don't know. I was just thinking. That just sounds like L.A. to me. It sounds like...
Whenever I hear 11 chords, of course, it sounds like L.A. Express, right?
It sounds like, I don't know.
You know, that was the first time I ever heard... I saw Robin, actually, was with George Harrison. Dark Horse Tour in Atlanta, Georgia, 71 or 72. You know, we all piled in my dad's Impala and went up there and paid like $6.50 to see the concert or something crazy like that. And it was at the Omni. And I remember, who the hell is that guitar player? Because I was just starting to get into guitar. I didn't start until I was like 17 years old, but... I remember seeing him, you know, it's like a little skinny guy with a big 335, you know, I didn't know what the hell it was, but I was, just proximity-wise, I was just right in front of where the amp, you know how amps are so directional, and he just blew me away, and I, of course, it had flyers then, you know, and there's a picture of him and who he was, and so I, of course, every record at that had his name on it, I went and bought, of course. That was like the LA Express with Tom Scott, and I think John Gearon might have been playing drums, I don't know.
Great fan.
Yeah. We'll be right back. see. How about what else can we do? Like like Sly and the Family Stone.
Yeah. What? What's the term?
It's F sharp. Oh, I see what you're saying.
I think that's
a little chromatic octave. Stuff to use, right? So you're playing nice altered stuff. You're putting all that MI knowledge.
MI.
To use.
Need a bridge. No.
Well, I have this other band called The Cookies I play with Bobby Watson and Donald Barrett and Max Ann Lewis sings, and it's...
You do those
it's
kind
funky,
of tunes.
Man. It's so much fun. Weakness. I mean, Bobby, you know, he's... don't ask him to retain... You know, he always forgets bridges and stuff for, like... And he can't read, really. But his groove is just so deep. You know, he played on Nothing From Nothing Leaves Nothing by Billy Preston. Wow. He played on Rock With You, the Michael Jackson hit. He played all that Rufus stuff.
Wow.
That was Bobby Watson. And he's just a special guy, you know. He just has, you know, his strength is his groove, for sure. Mm-hmm. When we play, man, that song, we take it someplace else. Yeah, that's a gig you missed the other night. That would have been...
Oh, shit, I wish I would have known. Yeah, I was around.
It was really great, fun. A new old club in town. I mean, it's called Vibrato. Herb Alpert owns this club, and it's
Man, Herb Alpert's still around?
I think he's still around.
Wow.
His little voice comes on at the club, you know, before saying, "Hey, everybody, this is Herb Alpert." So I think he's in his 80s. I think he's still around. Yeah. But the club is called Vibrato, and it's up in Beverly Hills area, up here where I live, over near Beverly Glen. So it's kind of swanky. It's expensive, but it's laid out. It reminds me of the clubs in Japan. Really. You know,
like Billboard Live
aesthetics are gorgeous. Yeah, but it's even like they have the Cotton Club.
Yeah,
it's just really laid out beautifully. I mean, they have great food. They treat the band great. The sound system is awesome. Mm-hmm. There's nothing else in Los Angeles that I know is like that. I mean, it's funny. LA is a weird place away. It's like there's not like in New Orleans. There's like a strip of blocks, block after block of like clubs, right? Where you can go to an area and kind of walk to a few different places or. In L.A., there's like, you know, you go to one club, you want to go to another one, it's a half-hour drive.
Yeah.
You know, there's really not one area where there's like a music hang like that, which is crazy with this town as big as Los Angeles.
Oh, yeah.
But there's like, place you played, what was the name of the place you played?
Oh, last night, 1881.
Okay.
Pasadena. Yeah.
That's kind of a new place. I mean, I don't think it's been there that long.
I mean,
long.
That place is, it's yeah. like a, it was like some New Orleans dive bar.
Right.
But it's a scene, man. It was a nice, cool little spot.
Yeah, Joel's been doing his thing up there. Says he's threatening to get me in there at some point. And then the Catalina Bar and Grill, which moved around the corner from where it used to be. And now it's kind of like, I don't know, I don't think it's a really great venue. I mean, to me, it's not as intimate. You don't feel like you're a part of the show. I don't know. The clubs in Japan are just so, you know, it's like you're going to a great restaurant. Everything's vibey and it's got, and the sound systems at Vibrato is awesome. Big Potato has a great sound system.
Yeah.
But once again, it's just like one little square room about as big as my apartment, right?
Remember the night we went to La Vallee to hear Scott? No.
Yeah, Landau's there and Landau, his wife.
Yeah, we were hanging out. That was fun. That place is gone, right?
Way gone, yeah. And there's a place called Le Café. You remember Le Café?
I remember it, yeah.
That was up in the valley.
I think
up a flight of stairs. That's gone. There's Shelley's Manhole and Dante's. I think Baked Potato's like the only one that's really left from
the It's amazing, the scene, how many great, great players are in Los Angeles, and there's like not a lot of places to play. Same in New York, man. There's like 55 Bar, and there's a couple others where, you know, unless you're doing straight-ahead jazz.
Right.
And 22 years old wearing a suit. You know,
and whenever I see like, you know, YouTube of these new phenomenal guitar players playing like straight-ahead stuff, it's always like in a restaurant someplace. You can hear the blenders going off, and it's like... I mean, I guess there's the Iridium. That's a pretty... Is that
new? Iridium, but Iridium's more of a bigger... That's like a dinner club kind of thing. Yeah, that's a cool place. I've played there.
It's funny. You go over to Japan, there's like the clubs... I don't know. It's... Yeah, you're right. I mean, in America, you would think they'd be taking care of the musicians a little bit more. You know, they would be a little bit more of a... It doesn't seem like it gets the respect... That you get in other countries, you know.
I guess it doesn't, you have to have an audience for things, you know, unfortunately. I don't know.
Thank you.
let's talk about your new record, man. I know you played me some tracks. It's killing. And you want to talk a little bit about how it came to be and got any titles or
I'm still searching on titles. It kind of have like Yesterday's Underwear and whatever, old song. I had names I just happened to, whatever was happening in that moment at the time when I wrote the song, it kind of stuck on some of them, but we're going to fix that. Well, this CD, I was playing the Baked Potato about a year ago, and this guy came in who would always reserve a seat with his buddies at this one table, and I started to recognize him, we play there once a month at Baked Potato, and he came up one night, he says, "Hey, Alan, look, I'm a big fan. If I can ever help with you make a record, or if you ever want to see LeBron James, let me know." at the Staples Center. So I said, "What?" I thought it was kind of a weird thing. I just kind of crammed his card in my pocket. And the next day, I Googled this guy, and he was the CEO of AEG, which is a big promotional, but it's like Live Nation thing. So he's a guitar nut, but he made a decision years ago that he wasn't going to try to, struggle and be a musician, an artist. He figured he'd go the business route, and he did it quite well. He started the Beverly Theater here in Los Angeles back in the 70s or 80s. He borrowed a bunch of money from friends and started that. He booked everything at Madison Square Garden for 10 years. And he's just, he's got a lot of money and he's a down to earth guy, and he collects vintage guitars and he loves the way I play and loves my old other CDs. So he said, "Look, let's make a record." So he's kind of bankrolling everything himself out of his pocket. And, he's not like he's not dictating like what I should play or anything. He said, "Alan, tell me if I'm talking too much." I said, "No, as long as you don't tell me there's too much cowbell or something like that."
He's basically executive producer. That's what
he's executive producer. Yeah, exactly. And he makes some comments sometimes, but he's like, he enabled me to go. I always have songs kind of in the works, and I had some new ideas I thought were pretty strong, and so he listened to the demos and he liked them, and so he booked the East West Studios. We got the great J.J. Blair to come in there, engineer, mic up everything, and brought Lenny Castro in, Jimmy Johnson. My band is Travis Carlton, Larry Carlton's son on bass, and Donald Barrett and Matt Rohde. My friend Rogerio Jardim sings. So it's coming together great. I'm just waiting for the guy who I want to mix the CD. His name is Rich Breen, who did the Yellow Jackets and Billy Childs, and he had been working with Lyle Mays right before Lyle Mays passed away. So his time was kind of consumed with all that stuff at the time, so I'm getting in and starting on Monday. We're going to finish the record. So we've already kind of done about 5 songs, but we haven't had a chance to touch them up. We just did it one day, and so we're hopefully going to finish it this next week. And Jay, because he has the wherewithal, he's going to try to push the CD a lot. He's going to put ads in all the magazines and try to get me out there. But it's different. My records in the past, I never spent a lot of time on making solos, burning. That's kind of the way I record. When I record a solo, I'll just turn it on, I'll record, and I'll get the general contour of the solo. Because I figure that the first instinct is usually right, as far as like at least knowing where the dynamics are, where you back off, where you kind of lay in, where you shred, And in the past, I'd kind of let it kind of lie where it was and kind of leave it up to, that was the zeitgeist. That was the moment in time when that's the way it was supposed to be. And I might pass a few small things, but this one I really spent time and made sure every solo was really, even though a couple of the solos were first take through, which I'm proud of those. But a couple of the other ones, I really spent some time and made sure they were really super burning, without sounding too contrived. Yeah, we're taking our time. We're making sure this one really counts. And it's going to sound... I know it'll sound better than all my other records, sonically.
It already sounds great. Just what you pulled up there. It's not even a mix. And it's
this is just my stuff here at home. Yeah. That's like a mix. That's like temp, comp of the drums.
Now, you played me something in New Orleans. The tune you just played me, you played me when you came to my studio in New Orleans or a few months ago, and you said that... was it Joe Bonamassa lent you one of his Dumble amps?
Well, J.J. Blair, who engineered this of his good friends, has done Joe's records. And he has Joe, and I kind of know Joe. We see each other around town. I see him in Guitar Center Vintage Room. So he kind of knows who I am. I know who he is. He's done a really great job of, branding the name Bonamassa, of course, as we all know. He's a great player. But he's friends with J.J., so he said, let Alan use the Dumble for this session. So, I said, sure. And actually, when I recorded at that studio, I was more or less kind of just conducting everybody. I really wasn't paying real close attention to what I was playing because I was just trying to make sure that I got all the parts down. But we ended up keeping a lot of the tracks, and the Dumble sounded awesome, of course. I never really realized how good they could sound until I realized how good.
Never had the opportunity to realize.
Not many people have. Yeah, it's amazing how well it just trans. Something about the way it translates on tape. I mean, when you hear it back, it's like, wow, I can hear every. It's this really articulate sounding amplifier. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't use it for many of my. I'll play you another song in a minute that I recorded that the solo was first take through on that amp. It sounds pretty awesome. But yeah, they're kind of special amps. I mean, I don't know. To me, it did one thing really good. Really well, better than anything. You know, that was kind of
was
crunchy.
$100,000 well worth it?
We'll I guess it depends on how much you got in the bank.
Your equipment here, these amplifiers sound great, man. This one is an old. I guess I'm playing through this old Deluxe Reverb.
Yeah, it originally was like a 69 or 70, I don't know, or 71 Deluxe, but it's been rebuilt. Dave Friedman. What's this place called now? It used to be called. He makes Friedman amps, of course, but he works at a place called Tone Merchant.
Oh, is that okay? Somebody told me to check that place out. He built my first pedal board for me years ago.
He's awesome. He's been a good friend. He's just totally everything he does. He knows what he's doing. And I have an old Gibson Invader over there with 112 and an 8-inch.
Smell that thing! The cloth wire and the two is cool.
Isn't that great?
Yeah,
it's like my own little room. Aromatherapy, you know, that amp being on.
Yeah.
I don't know if it was the tubes or the cloth or what it is. And that's a Bob Burt made me a bunch of cabinets. I have a lot of his stuff around. He makes really great stuff. And the Red Plate guys, which that unfortunately they're like out of business.
Man, that amp sounds really good.
It sounds really great. They, you know, like everybody, they were trying to copy the Dumble sound. So there's something about the way the effects loop is in it, is integrated into the overdrive section. I don't know. I just know it works really good for me. When I heard it, I had to have it. And they gave me a couple of those. So, yeah, I'm lucky. If I had more room, I don't have a lot of room up here, as you can see, but it's like, I live like a little Japanese guy. You know, I got to have everything's got to be right in the right place or else it's cluttered. If I'm coming in and out of the house, I'm working a lot, the place is like you can barely walk anywhere. But yeah, I love it up here, man.
Well, man, I look forward to hearing that record.
I'm excited too. It's going to be called The Good Fight. Because if anybody knows me from my Facebook rants the last few years, I'm kind of outspoken critic of some things that go on politically.
Oh, okay. I'm not on Facebook, so I don't have a personal.
Good for you. Me and Leland Sklar have been banned several times.
Oh, really?
And actually, I don't use profanity ever. I just, you know, sometimes when you copy a meme from a place that's been blacklisted, they'll cut you off for a week. And I posted something about, I just said something like, I didn't use any curse words, but they said that it was just classified under hate speech. So I don't know what that's about. But anyway, the way I look at it, I'm just kind of a part of the resistance in this day and age. It's a weird world we live in. And I'm just outspoken. My mother was the same way. When I was growing up in Alabama, we used to go into Walmart there, and she'd get in arguments with the cashier because she was wearing a Obama sticker or something liberal. You know, she'd get my mom would like they'd get in a big argument. I'd say, "Mom, can we go?" But I find I'm kind of the same way. I kind of feel something a little bit disturbing about what's happening in America right now. But that's another podcast. But the record's called Good Fight, and that's kind of that's where the names came from anyway. But I have like a whole string section on a couple songs. Pedal steel. Rich Hinman is playing some pedal steel on it. I got your friend Pat Bergeson.
Pat Bergeson.
He plays some killer harmonica. Great. Did I send it to you?
But you asked me for his number, and you said, "Man, I never heard back from Pat."
We got in touch, and he's
great. He was a guest on Riff Raff too.
I heard that. Check it out. He's a fascinating. He's a great guitar player.
Man, he's a great guitar player.
You know, it's a whole other world. My students kind of keep me. They go, "Hey, Alan, you need to be doing all these videos every day, like 1-minute videos with the aesthetic right, and you need to go to this website, and you need to pay them for a future." I go, "What?" And it's like a. It's like you can go to these websites and pay them like, $10, and then they'll spit out your stuff to like a whole new demographic all over the world. I guess that's what a lot of guys are doing now.
I'm glad you brought this up because it seems like there's a lot. I touched on this a little bit with Wayne Krantz, but it seems like there's a lot of guys now, and I mean no disrespect at all for people listening, but it seems like there are guys that maybe they've never even done, quote, real gigs.
Right.
This YouTube thing is that's it, and they've been able to monetize it. And God bless them, man. I don't have shit for followers. I haven't ever really tried to do that stuff, but I'm wondering, like, when how much is too much, man? Like, well, guitar players post every day, and it's like, I guess the world is so big where it can absorb, you know. I mean, I'm sure you have a lot of people that would love to see videos every day, but
you know, I've never put one video myself of anything live. I mean, everything that's up there is like other people have put up there, which is probably good and bad. I mean, there's probably some crap up there where I played, you know, because, you know, I mean, I'm not the kind of guy who can turn on and just like turn on inspiration or make it sound inspired. I kind of have to be inspired. I has to be the moment, the gear has to sound right. I have to be and luckily I've gotten to that place enough where I've been able to make a career doing it. But I remember, this takes me back to when I used to do studio stuff, and I'd go into a studio and they'd say, hey man, can you do that lucrative thing? Or they want you to do something that you're just not. And I just realized at some point that I was not that guy. And these days, I mean, teaching at musicians, this is where I get kind of a cross-section of all young guys who come in who have incredible technique, and they have great, I mean, I don't know if they can write songs or if they have that much original to say, but it's really licky, and it's really, I don't know what I'm trying to say. It's like it's genetically engineered kind of good pop stuff, but without the songs or something like that. It's just like somebody said the other day, somebody said it's like a Woody Allen joke where he goes, the way to a woman's heart is through sincerity and honesty. And if you can fake that, and that's what it seems like to me, like they've kind of copied all the right movements and the right, but it's lacking something to me. And that could be, maybe it's just because I'm old, but yeah, it's a whole
new
world up
there.
Do
you think it's because they don't interact with other musicians in a garage somewhere?
That's got to be,
you know,
a lot of it,
isn't
it?
Sitting in front of a laptop with a garage band, you know, or loops or things. I mean,
that's got to be what it is, because there's that, and that's the beautiful thing when you listen to an old Steve Winwood record or Beatles or any of that kind of old stuff. There was a special place the band gets to just from being with each other and from working off of each other in a track or a composition or whatever that I don't really hear very much these days. So I don't know. It's got to be the advent of the technology to where we can just be their own player in their own living room and not interact, which brings us to the coronavirus. Everybody's like walling off. Everybody's in their bubble this week, aren't they?
By the time this gets edited and out there, it'll be interesting to see where we are, because, you know, it'll be a little while before I finish this one, but right now, man, it's pure panic mode.
It's crazy. I mean, it's like, yeah, we've been talking about this some. It's, you know, people are stocking up on toilet paper because there's a virus out there. It's not like, I mean, I hope it's not. I mean, it feels like there's, you know, like Night of the Living Dead or something. It feels like, you know, everybody's off the streets. Everybody's like walling themselves in their own little rooms and buying. I found myself going to the supermarket and I bought a bunch of steaks and salmon to freeze, so I could, you know, eat for and not have to go outside for the next week. And I'm thinking, why? I mean, I'm pretty healthy and I don't think even if I caught the damn thing, I would die. But
the media tells us otherwise.
The media tells us otherwise, and meanwhile, the whole world is closed down. That was a good lick. Yeah, almost got there. Almost got to the mountaintop.
Nice, Alan.
Hey, what are you going to do for dinner? You have plans?
No.
You want to go get something to eat in a minute?
Sure, man.
I got a couple good places we can go.
Let's go.
That's sushi.
Hey, Alan, thank you so much.
Yeah, man, sure.
For getting
together.
My
pleasure. On a rainy day, this is a fun thing to do.
A rainy day in L.A. It's
such a rare thing.
So surreal.
But I love having all my windows up and my cats laying around.
Yeah.
It's a comfortable place
Old
up here.
Old amps.
It's as close to Alabama as I can get without leaving Los Angeles.
You're in L.A.
You're Alabama.
Not in lower Alabama. You're in L.A., L.A. But yeah, I always joke about that. All right.
Well, great, Shane. It was good seeing you again, man. It was lots of fun.
Likewise.
All right, man. Riff-rap.
Thank you, everyone, for if you're still here, hanging in there. I hope you enjoyed that. It was so fun hanging out with Alan. Hit him up on Facebook, Instagram. Hit him up for a Skype lesson. Hit me up on Instagram, Facebook, if you haven't already. Appreciate the followers. Appreciate the kind comments on iTunes. Regardless of where you follow Riff Raff, help spread the word. And take care. Thanks for tuning in.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 Dream Beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.